Сегодня следствие проводит обыски у организаторов.
А также списки сторонников Сергея Удальцова, Алексея Навального, Ильи
Яшина. У меня ощущение, что это некая политическая...
Уже в Москве Бастрыкин с подчиненными вывез Соколова.
Well, it's been a wild, wild week, even by Russian standards. It began with agents from the investigative committee searching the apartments of leading opposition figures, including anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny, socialite-turned-social activist Ksenia Sobchak, and left-front leader Sergei Udaltsov, and others. And it wrapped up with a noisy scandal that saw investigative committee chief Alexander Bastrykin accused of effectively challenging an opposition journalist to a duel, having him dragged out to the forest and threatening to kill him. And in between, an estimated 60,000 people took to the streets in Moscow, defying an ongoing crackdown and a draconian new law aimed at thwarting public gatherings. In the tense ongoing standoff between the authorities and the opposition, both showed their strengths and their weaknesses this week. But at the same time, neither side has been able to truly exploit the other's vulnerabilities. The opposition has demonstrated again and again that it can put tens of thousands of people on the streets, but this broad coalition of liberals, leftists, and nationalists agree on little other than their common disdain for Putin. And this was reflected in the more or less empty manifesto they issued this week. The authorities, of course, have the full weight of the Russian state at their disposal, but everything they do, from legislation curtailing demonstrations to early morning searches of activists' apartments to brazen attempts to intimidate journalists, seem only to embolden the Kremlin's foes. How long will this deadlocked standoff continue? And what does the bizarre and twisted scandal surrounding Alexander Bastrykin and the investigative committee say about the state of the Russian elite? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University and an expert on Russian security services, to discuss the Bastrykin scandal in detail. But first, let's put the other events of the week into some context. The authorities are clearly trying to crack down, but it appears to be having little effect on the opposition. Alexei Navalny, Ksenia Sobchak, and others were again being questioned by the investigative committee today, which is itself is still mired in scandal. And there are signs that the crackdown is deepening splits within the ruling elite and even among the Siloviki, something I'm sure Mark will weigh in on later in the program. It appears, Kirill, as you said in the podcast last week, that we're in for a long and protracted standoff. So what do you think? Is time on the Kremlin side or is time on the side of the demonstrators?
Neither of them. Okay. Do you remember this Rolling Stones song, Time is on My Side?
Of course,
maybe.
I remember. I'm almost 50 years old.
No Putin, no Navalny or whoever in their position, they're not Mick Jagger. Both of the collective players in this political game, they have strong and weak points. And it is very interesting. The most interesting thing in this context is that the strong points are the weak ones in some conditions and so, and vice versa. For instance, a strong point of modern Russian opposition is that, as you told, a broad coalition of a lot of political forces and movements and so on, from liberals to nationalists. But that's why this opposition is going on now, and it can gather several tens of thousand people.
They're putting just as many people on the streets now as they did on Bolotnaya Ploshchad, right after the Duma elections.
From the December 2011, the numbers of those who are participating in the protests are the same.
Contrary to everybody's predictions, including mine and yours.
Yes, sure. And that is the strong point of the opposition, because they can gather such numbers of people during the protests, because it is a broad coalition. This is a strong point. But at the same time, this is the most weak point of their position, because they don't have any political, common political or mutual political ideas or and so on. Look at this manifesto.
Other than Putin must go.
Yes. Just a figure of Putin who is just irritating to everyone in the position, and that's all. No any positive program, right. And even this manifesto of the Free Russia, which had been during the protest on the 12th of June, it's just a good utopian, very. Very weak program.
It's
as
empty.
A program.
Empty is the
it's
word.
It's empty. Yes. I tried to avoid this word.
I have no problem using it, but it's empty for a reason. To appeal to such a broad coalition, It can't help but be empty.
Sure, but if you gather such different people in during one protest, you have to speak to tell them something that could unite them.
It's the least common denominator. And that appears to be Putin must go.
Yeah. And that is the weakest point, because, opposition couldn't survive without strong organization, without strong appeals to and strong political program. If we turn to the power, or to Kremlin, or to Putin himself, and so on, there's a strongest point is that they are the power.
They're the state.
They're the state, they're the power, yeah? Of course, they can do, theoretically, they can do everything with the opposition, to arrest them, to beat them, to shoot them, or just to discuss some points with them, yeah? But this strong point is the weakest one at the side of the Kremlin, Putin, and so on, because power or being a state, this situation is that you are inside a very strong limitations.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you are state, and if you are not just totalitarian state and so on, if you proclaim yourself as a democratic state and whatever, so you have to behave like this.
Even a managed democratic state.
Yes, yes.
Sovereign democratic state.
Behave like that, because you have the opposition, democratic opposition, and strong opposition media inside the country, and you have the strong opinion of the West. And you have the assets outside the country, in the Western banks, and so on. So in this case, you can do something strong in this situation.
So Putin can't turn into Lukashenko, to put it.
Sure, surely,
He can't. He just won't be able to do that.
Yes. So that's why I told you that time is not on the side of Kremlin or opposition and so on.
But the logical question follows for me is why? Okay, you just laid out the weakness of the opposition. Let's begin with that. Their weakness is the fact that it's a broad, that the coalition's so broad that they can't agree on anything. Now, the Kremlin I used to know that was really deft politically, the Kremlin we saw over the past decade, would exploit that. They'd bring a liberal into the government and try to divide the opposition, or they'd bring a nationalist into the authorities and try to divide or a leftist. They would try to split this thing up
They could do this a year ago, but not now.
Why not?
Because when they had opportunities and they had a bright, in any sense, bright minds behind the political scene and so on, they can, they can play with the situation. Now, when they cross the line during the protests and riots on the 6th of May, they can do this because now nationalists, they are strict enemies of a state and Kremlin. Now the leftist groups, and especially after these searches and so on, they are strictly the enemies and so on. So liberals, of course, you can try to draw some liberals to the political circles, and they tried to do this. For instance, several days ago, they offered Irina Prokhorova, she is a sister of Mikhail Prokhorov, mm-hmm. and a prominent liberal publisher in Russia, and they offered her a kind of position in the kind of public council by or inside the Ministry of the Culture.
Mm-hmm.
But after...
It's kind of small potatoes.
Yes, though, but after they appointed Medinsky, notorious nationalist Medinsky and whatever we can speak about him, as a minister...
Right.
Of course, Irina Prokhorova and no one from liberal circle will
go into the culture ministry. Yeah.
So that is the limits of the recent situation with the Kremlin. You know,
they have some nationalists on their side. I mean, Rogozin, Medinsky.
They're not nationalists. They're just political players who play with such cards.
Go ahead and say political prostitutes. You can say that.
I'm avoiding such lexics. Yeah. So that is the answer to a question. They cannot divide their position now. A position can be divided by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But not by Kremlin. That is the different situation from that June 2011.
Now, the opposition isn't the only thing divided. We're starting to see serious splits, and it came out with the Bastrykin scandal that we'll discuss in detail later. But the moderate wing in the Kremlin and in the government, the so-called technocrats, or what we've called the managers, they're appalled at the methods being used by the Siloviki in this crackdown, and the splits in the elite are getting more and more sharp right now. I mean, we're beginning to really see them almost come out in the open. Why can't the opposition exploit that?
Because, first of all, they had a very strong connections to Kremlin and the Putin circle. This is the first thing. Of course, Sergei Parkhomenko or some other political leaders of Russian opposition, they have a close connections to Alexei Kudrin and some of other ex or recent Kremlin figures or White House figures. But these connections are not kind of a political. It's social, cultural. They belong to the same social or social cultural group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of so-called Russian...
That means something, though.
Yes, this means something, but not very much, because in some other situations, all these Kremlin liberals can turn to whatever. So to divide Kremlin and to divide this enemy of Russian opposition, of course, they have to use political instruments, not social, not, ideological even, and so on. But if you want to use political instrument, political tool, you have to have a very clear understanding what's going on inside Kremlin. But no one knows this. That is the problem, first of all. And secondly, who will try to divide Kremlin from the opposition side? Because opposition has no united body or council or so on. So this is a political decision, and this kind of political decision has to be done by someone who has some power or abilities or authority or whatever.
So we're in for what? Just a long period of a standoff that's going to not really go anywhere? Or now, for example, the opposition announced this week they're calling off big demonstrations until, what is it, October, right?
Firstly, they told that they will organize the demonstration and so on Putin's birthday. It was a grave political mistake because
that's the day showed, Anna Politkovskaya was shot.
But this showed that their main aim is not a future, Russian future and so on, but just Putin.
Right.
They tried to revenge him personally.
Right.
And that was a very serious political mistake.
That's a good point, actually.
And then they changed their mind and appointed the protest on September.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting, yeah, you know?
Yeah. Now, another interesting event's happening in the fall, and that's the whole bunch of regional elections where United Russia appears to be about to lose its majority in a lot of
There are some rumors from the administration about this.
They're even putting out signals themselves that the United Russia may be losing its majority. I don't know if that's going to be a game changer or not, But what do you see happening? Do we just are we just going in for a long period of indecisive instability?
Yes, I can predict. I hate all such things, but I can predict a period of kind of chaotic period of Russian politics and history till the September or maybe October 2012. Mm-hmm. Then after that, something will happen. Something will happen. Or the Kremlin or United Russia or all this regime will try to change itself.
Mm-hmm.
Or something, I think, very serious will happen in Russia because it will coincide with all these reforms of the...
The rising prices, the social reforms,
and all the utilities and so on.
Yeah.
So this is a very serious thing.
Lost in all this discussion is the fact that this government is going to have to, but for economic reasons, and Alexei Kudrin has pointed this out again and again and again, carry out very painful reforms on the healthcare system, the pension system, and on the public utility system. And this is going to really hit some people in their pocketbooks, and it's going to that could be, as much as the elections in October could be a game changer.
Yes, that is my idea, that till these protests are strong inside Moscow,
mm-hmm.
in the limits of Moscow and maybe Moscow, big Moscow, so-called large Moscow, it's a very important, very interesting events and so on, but they are not crucial for the future of the country and so on. If the situation will grow and will go to regional centers and then to the provincial towns, mm-hmm. and so on. So that will be really serious.
Right. The way, I guess, if I had to make a not a prediction but an assessment right now, I mean, what I see is this is going to be decided inside the ruling circle and in this battle between, for lack of a better term, the Siloviki and the technocrats, right? And right now, the Siloviki seem to be winning that battle inside the Kremlin. But the presence of the protest movement on the street and its strength only strengthens possibly could strengthen the technocratic wing actually in the long run, and especially once these social reforms come in, and it might tip the balance. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll see. In a few moments, we'll go into detail about the machinations surrounding what the Russian media has been calling the forest scandal, and bring in a special guest, Mark Galeotti of New York University, who will no doubt have a lot to say on the subject. I would like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
I would like to begin by offering my apologies to Dmitry Andreevich and his newspaper for the emotional breakdown that I allowed myself at the meeting.
That was Alexander Bastrykin, head of the investigative committee, after meeting with Novaya Gazeta's editor-in-chief Dmitry Muratov, sort of apologizing for a heated argument he had with the paper's deputy editor Sergei Sokolov while the two were attending a security conference in Nalchik last week. An audio recording of that exchange in Nalchik showed Bastrykin suggesting that he and Sokolov have a duel over Novaya Gazeta's coverage of the investigative committee's work. Bastrykin did not, to our knowledge, admit to the more explosive allegations against him, having Sokolov hauled out to a forest near outside of Moscow and threatening his life. Admitting this would, of course, in fact, constitute admitting to a very, very serious crime. Meanwhile, speculation abounds about what is behind all this. The simple explanation is that the Siloviki have been given more or less carte blanche in dealing with the Kremlin's opponents, and Bastrykin just took it a little bit too far. Others have suggested the whole affair is part of a big struggle within the ruling elite. Joining us now via Skype to put all of this into context for us is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on the Russian security services, and author of the excellent blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark. You're becoming a bit of a regular in the podcast, and that's fine with me.
And with me.
Mark, this scandal seems to have more twists and turns and subterfuge than a David Lynch film. What do you see going on here?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, very much a sign of the times and a sign of the growing tensions, but also paranoias, I think, within the sort of the Siloviki, in that, and it's very hard to be precisely sure about what happened and what might be going on. But as near as I can tell from my conversations with people, Bastrykin felt that the articles in Nova Gazeta was part of a sort of a political struggle against him from within the Siloviki, that essentially they were acting as front men, and he overreacted as a result. I don't believe for a minute it was more than just journalists doing their job. But nonetheless, I think it shows something about the rather heightened emotions that are currently sort of reigning within these rarefied political circles.
Now, we assume a lot of knowledge on the part of our listeners here at the Power Vertical podcast, but this is one twisted and complicated affair, so I kind of feel compelled just to lay out the outlines of it for everybody. On Wednesday of this week, Muratov, the editor-in-chief of Nova Gazeta, published an open letter accusing Bastrykin of threatening the life of his deputy editor, Sergei Sokolov, having his security guards take him out to a forest outside of Moscow and threatening his life. This happened after the two had a heated argument in Nalchik, where both were attending a security conference in which Bastrykin essentially challenged him to a duel over Novaya Gazeta's coverage of the investigative committee's work. Bastrykin was silent for an entire day, and on Thursday he came out and admitted, it came out in the morning in an article in his Vestia, essentially denying the story, denying the story, saying it was the subject of Muratov's fevered imagination, and accusing the opposition of using it as kind of constructing the scandal as a vendetta against him. Later in the day, after meeting with Muratov, he came out and offered this very oblique apology, apologizing for his emotional breakdown and for arguing with Sokolov, but did not mention and did not deny.
After that, he mentioned that it wasn't really the forest, but it was kind of a side of the road when they spoke and so on. But he didn't reject at all the thing.
The essence of the allegation that he threatened his life.
Yeah.
Mark, do you see one of the things in the press that has come out about this is that it might be a battle between the investigative committee and the prosecutor general's office. Do you see that? Do you see that as a possible explanation for what's going on?
Well, let me give you that very unsatisfying academic's answer, both yes and no. Certainly, there is a power struggle going on between the investigative committee, the prosecutor general's office, and the Interior Ministry, the MVD, in part because the Investigative Committee is emerging as this kind of super policing agency, pretty much outside of any oversight except the direct control of the president, and able to basically go and snoop on and, if necessary, sort of purge any other arm of the government. So, yes, that is one of the underlying issues. But, as I said, I really don't believe that this particular case was part of some complex subterranean attack on him. I think it just that's what he was expecting, and that's what he chose to see in the newspaper articles.
I agree with you that this case wasn't part of some subterranean plot. I think it was just the Nova Gazeta journalists doing their work. But after the fact, is it possible that Bastrykin's enemies within the elite are using this against him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's clear that they're quite delighted to have a man who, let's face it, you know, it's interesting, he is in some ways a little bit of a mini Putin. You know, he has tried to sort of cultivate this image of himself as the sort of cold, hard Czechist for the new era. And to find himself, you know, in a situation where he's not only been caught, you know, in this, let's call it an emotional outburst, but clearly lost it, and in the process made a fool of himself. You know, that's clearly something that is being relished by his rivals, because they can also use it for political purposes to say, look, this is why the investigative committee shouldn't be regarded as the crucial institution of power. And also, you know, beforehand, we have a whole issue you haven't mentioned yet, I'm sure you will, the whole Kinstein
Yeah, no, I want to get the Hinstein as a whole other aspect of it. There's two things that kind of got my attention to say that there's more to this than meets the eye. One of them was the transcripts from Nalchik, where Bastrykin essentially challenged Sokolov to a duel. These were published in LifeNews.ru, a tabloid website with known or rumored connections to the security services. This is the same website that published...
Definitely connected.
Okay. If you're comfortable with that, Kirill, so am I. This is the same website that published the transcripts of Boris Nemtsov's telephone conversations, for example. That was number one. Number two, I was attentively, very closely paying attention to Russian television that day. And they were covering the story pretty straight. And in fact, they were covering it more from Novaya Gazeta's perspective than from anything. And that kind of set alarm bells going off in my head that there was more to this than meet the eye. And you brought up Hinstein, Alexander Hinstein, former investigative journalist, now a deputy with United Russia in the State Duma, tweeted 2 days before the story broke that a major scandal is awaiting Bastrykin. He did this on Monday, June the 11th, while the apartments of Ksenia Sobchak and Alexei Navalny were being searched. And he tweeted that this big scandal is coming. 2 days later, this big scandal came. And after Bastrykin's sort of not really almost apology on Thursday, Hinstein came out with another comment saying, this isn't over. I want to investigate Bastrykin's behavior. So this all suggests that, and I agree with you, this wasn't some subterranean plot from the start, but once this story broke, Bastrykin's enemies jumped all over it. Who, Mark, are Bastrykin's enemies inside of the elite? He seems to be aligned with Igor Sechin, with Nikolai Patrushev, with Sergei Ivanov, the heavy hitters among the Siloviki. Who are his enemies?
Well, I think this is one of the interesting things. We try and look for these neat factions, who is against whom. And yet it tends to break down along sort of institutional lines and so forth. I mean, on one level, as it were, in broad political ideological terms, exactly, Bastrykin is very much aligned with the sort of the statist faction, which includes, for example, the FSB, the Federal Security Service, which is Patrushev's old service and such like. However, institutionally, Bastrykin has managed to anger the Prosecutor General, Yuri Chaika, the Interior Ministry, whom it's now set up a new department within the Investigative Committee to actually specifically, basically, investigate cops, but also the Federal Security Service, that actually thinks that a lot of these functions that the Investigative Committee is carrying out, really it should be carrying out. And I must admit, I can't help but feel that the FSB's fingerprints are on a lot of this subsequent publicity campaign. If you exist within this rarefied upper echelon of the security elite, you know, everyone is basically watching everyone else. Everyone will be maintaining sort of, you know, we'll be listening and keeping transcripts and so forth. But I very much suspect that actually it's the FSB that was very eager to leak it. One thing is worth noting about both the Investigative Committee and specifically Bastrykin. Bastrykin is good at playing, shall I say, Kremlin politics. He's managed to sort of take himself, well, when he was notionally subordinate to Yuri Chaika, the Prosecutor General, he was able to pretty much ignore his boss. Now he's moved himself up to a situation where he reports directly to the President. He's done very well there. However, he's never really understood or played a part in wider politics, in terms of building a constituency within the media, within other arms of government and so forth. And I think this is definitely coming back to bite him. He is not a particularly good player of, shall I say, the public side of elite politics.
Do you think he's expendable from the perspective of the elite? And Kirill, I'd like you to weigh in on this as well. Is he somebody that they could sacrifice? Or is he too important and too much a part of the inner circle to sacrifice?
Well, I mean, my view is that pretty much everyone is expendable, quite frankly, unless they have a really, really strong personal relationship with Putin. And even then, you know, as we've seen with Kudrin, even that doesn't necessarily give you full immortality. The thing about Bastrykin is, I mean, he very much has built his career on being useful. I don't think he has a really strong personal relationship with the man. Instead, he's useful. And I'll be honest, there are umpteen wannabe Bastrykins who would very happily step into his shoes.
So he is replaceable and we could see him go then, which would be a huge victory for the opposition.
Yeah, but I don't think it would be an... I mean, the opposition would be heartened, but it wouldn't be a victory for them. Mm. It would be just simply be another struggle within the sort of the elite bounds. Mm.
Kirill?
First of all, my answer is sacrifice what for? What is the aim of this sacrifice? To show that Kremlin is connected to the public, consciousness or mind or interests and so on, to show that Kremlin is supporting journalists against what? Or in their fight for free speech and so on. But the situation around Bastrykin and Novaya Gazeta isn't such clear as we are thinking about this.
Well, that will
First of all, Sokolov's article in question is very poor, is very bad.
And there was only one line in the whole article that even mentioned Bastrykin, incidentally.
Yes, but it's very emotional. It's not an information.
It was a commentary.
Yes, it's commentary, but if you are a journalist in every country, so you have to have some limits in such things. Yes, because the thing that they are tried to describe, the situation around this Kuchevskaya criminal case and
this
so
this mass on, murder that took place in the town of Kuchevskaya in Krasnodarsky Krai in southern Russia, in which a local criminal band with tight ties to the local authorities and the prosecutors and the police, where he murdered 12 people, including 4 children. What got Sokolov so incensed was the very, very light sentence, a very light fine. What was it, like something for, ridiculously low? It was like,
yes, but
for one of the
yes,
one
but
of
the
people
crime
to cover
was,
this up.
Well, the crime was not very serious. That is the question.
Covering up the murder of 12
yes,
people?
Yes, covering. It's not just covering, because they covered the one thing where they bought this gasoline.
But
to,
it's still accessory to murder. He's accessory to murder in the criminal code in this sense.
Sure, but we can discuss. Or
the man in question
know.
Was United Russia deputy, very influential United Russia deputy from in the region for in the municipal legislature, and he, as I understand, he covered up the receipts of the for the gasoline where they burned down this farmer's house where 12 people had been stabbed to death. Now that's accessory to murder, and he got a fine in the equivalent of less than $5,000, or a lot less than it would be if you violated public order during a sanctioned opposition demonstration,
yes,
for example.
But you can say everything, all these things, to Russian court,
right,
who decided so, but not to investigative committee. That is the first problem with this article.
If you had a normal kind of, and I think the point of this article, though, is if you had a normal judicial system, yes, you could say this
okay,
to the court.
But
we know we operate in a system where police and prosecutors rule and the courts just carry out their orders. And if the police and prosecutors wanted a heavy sentence, they would have gotten one. So
yes, but I'm not defending Bastrykin and so on, but the tone of this article.
The tone was,
And insulting tone, because Sokolov wrote that practically investigative committee and Bastrykin just on the side of the criminals.
Yes, that there. Yeah.
Of course, this is very dubious, firstly. Secondly, Novaya Gazeta has very close connections to investigative committee itself, because some of the journalists, I can remind you, Anna Politkovskaya and so on, had been murdered during last 10 years, and investigative committee investigated all these cases.
In cooperation with Novaya Gazeta, which is conducting its own investigation. And actually, Dmitry Muratov, after Bastrykin's apology, non-apology, said that we received security guarantees for our journalists, and now we can continue our investigation into the Politkovskaya killing.
Yes. And thirdly, if you are accusing such person like Bastrykin, chief of an investigative committee, that he threatened your journalists to kill him in the forest, and after apologizing of this Bastrykin, you are closing everything and speaking everything was okay, so I am absolutely satisfied, and so on. Everything is very dubious in this story, yeah? And that's why I am not sure that we can decide something, definitely. There are 3 or, I think, 4 versions of what happened.
Yeah.
three of them psychological,
right,
and one political. But the psychological ones are not, say, one are not purely psychological. Well, first, just ordinary explanation is that it was kind of, you know, emotional, as Bastrykin told. We can, in this case, yes, in this version, we can trust Bastrykin that it was just an emotional response to...
I listened to the tape in Nalchik, and he sounded pretty emotional.
Yes, yes. Secondly, another psychological version, that this is a revenge to Bastrykin himself, from the side of Alexander Lebedev,
the owner of
Gazeta, yes, a former KGB agent and billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Because investigative committee made some searches and actions against the banks,
his banks,
in Moscow and so on, and we all of us know that Lebedev is very, very strongly opposed investigative committee and Bastrykin himself.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, maybe the most interesting psychological version is that is the revenge of Vladislav Surkov to the recent head or not head, he's
the deputy Kremlin chief of staff
Vladislav Volodin, and that's why he's trying to make political situation in Russia a little bit chaotic, and this way we can explain everything, all these clashes with the police on the 6th of May and all the searches day before the opposition March of Millions on the 11th of June, and this story with Bastrykin.
That Surkov is trying to stir up trouble in,
yes,
general,
in general,
in order,
yes,
to make Volodin, who took his job in the Kremlin,
to
look
return
bad.
To
look bad.
Yes. And the fourth one, political, is just as... Marx told, that this is just a political struggle between the Office of General Prosecutor and the Investigative Committee, with the participation of the Interior Ministry and so on. So,
but regardless of which one of these, and when it's going to be impossible to know at this point, which one of these is actually has any weight, this whole thing makes Bastrykin, and by extension the Kremlin, look pretty bad, right?
I mean, David Lynch, you are absolutely right.
It's, oh, yeah. This
Blue
is,
Velvet.
My first in an email exchange, Mark and I said, it's like a Tarantino movie, but I think it's more, the more I think about it, and
Blue
I wrote that,
Velvet.
It's more like a Lynch movie. Mark, stepping back from all this, what is the state of the Siloviki right now? I mean, we've discussed this in the podcast before. There's a lot of discontent among the Siloviki, specifically in the lower ranks right now, isn't there?
There is. And I think the thing is, we've seen struggles between the Siloviki in the past. I mean, you've mentioned it on the blog and so forth. But on the whole, they have been in times when things were pretty safe, pretty stable. So effectively, there was self-indulgence. Now, though, I don't believe for a minute that the Putin regime is imminently in collapse. But nonetheless, I think from the point of view of a lot of Siloviki who thought they were there for good, there is now an exaggerated concern. And for some, it means that they're sort of lashing out angrily at each other. For some, they're thinking short-term instead of long-term, and to be blunt, embezzling as hard and as fast as they possibly can and getting that money out of the country just in case things suddenly change. But I think the main thing is there's a sense that they're not sure where they go now. I mean, it's quite interesting if you compare, for example, the investigative committee kicking down people's doors metaphorically and, you know, sort of very much sort of trying to put pressure on various protest leaders. Compare that with the fact that the Interior Ministry adopted, frankly, a pretty laid-back approach to the recent protests. And I don't think it's that because Kolokoltsev, the new Interior Minister, and the new Moscow Police Chief Yakunin are closet liberals.
Right.
It's clearly that that was their strategy, and it worked. But I think the thing is, it's clear that there's a whole variety of different strategies being floated.
So it's good cop, bad cop, very literally.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, putting too much of a strategy to it. I mean, I think it is actually more that different agencies and different individuals have different ideas. And I don't think they're getting a clear steer from Putin. I think this is it. I mean, I don't think it's actually that someone's saying, look, you and the Interior Ministry, you be good cops. I think it's just that Kolokoltsev is realistic and professional enough to realize that, in fact, there's no great gain at this stage to be sort of in trying to sort of lean on the protests, whereas Bastrykin's instincts are to be much more of an attack dog.
So it's almost in a spontaneous, very literal game of good cop, bad cop, where the Interior Minister has decided it's in our interest to be the good cop because this might go this way, and the investigative committee is digging at its heels and being the bad cop because it is very much invested in it going the other way. Is that, would that be an accurate description of it?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Okay. Now, the other thing, Mark, and Kirill, I wanted you both to weigh in on is that the last time we saw the Siloviki kind of go at each other's throats was back in 2007 in the famous Siloviki War. And Bastrykin was right in the middle of that, too. That was around the time that the investigative committee was formed. And there was different factions within the Siloviki that began fighting over access. But the context of that time, this was when Putin's second term in the Kremlin was wrapping up. It was before we really knew the tandem was going to come into being and that Putin was going to come back. It was very unclear what was going to go on then. Was Putin going to take a third term and change the constitution? Was he going to turn power over to Sergei Ivanov, who would be kind of an imitation of Putin? And then you had the strange appointment of Zubkov as prime minister. Yeah. And there was a lot of uncertainty. And among Kremlin watchers, there was a lot of head scratching. I imagine in the Kremlin itself, there was a lot of head banging. And this was the last time the Siloviki started behaving this way. And it was a result of the uncertainty they were facing. Now we're seeing them. Now Putin's back in the Kremlin. You'd think they'd be happy as clams. But we're starting to see this exact same behavior that we saw at the end of Putin 1.0 happening again at the beginning of Putin 2.0. What do you attribute that to? Same uncertainty. The uncertainty now is as great as it was back in 2007?
I think it's a different uncertainty. In 07, the issue was not, you know, can we hold on to power? It was really exactly the specific modalities. Is Putin going to hang on? What's going to be done and so forth? But in particular, I think for them, there was a sense actually of opportunity rather than crisis. I think it was that sense that this is a transitional moment in which actually it's a good chance to grab what you can grab. And that meant that we had a lot of, you know, and often it's personal and institutional and factional rivalries being played out. And one of the reasons for the creation of the investigation committee was precisely, you know, as a response to that, it was to sort of to squelch a lot of these issues. I think, yes, we're seeing rivalries amongst the Siloviki now, but I don't think it's quite so much because of a sense of, oh, isn't this great? We have new opportunities. It's quite the opposite. It's that they're not getting a strong steer or control from the center. That they aren't feeling as confident as they are, and they each have a different sense of what their personal and institutional interests are.
Kirill?
I think it's different. The situation is different because this uncertainty in 2007 had been limited, very limited, on the highest level of the power and Kremlin elite and so on. Five years ago, the opposition, Russian opposition was very isolated, and it was very weak. And I remember all this opposition pickets and demonstrations in 2007. They gathered just 100 or 200 people. Now this uncertainty is all over, you know, Moscow.
Right.
Moscow. It's of course it takes place in the highest level of power of the state and so on, definitely, and we see it in the case of Bastrykin. But at the same time, this dissatisfaction, this sense of chaotic events that are happening now, they're very broad inside a very broad large parts of Moscow population, creative class, intelligentsia, and some bureaucrats, and so on. So now the situation is much more serious than it was 5 years ago, and I am not sure that this crisis, maybe it's local crisis, but anyway, will end up just kind of safely for the Kremlin.
Right. Yeah, if in 2007, what I'm hearing is we had a Siloviki war over opportunity, and yes. Now we're having a Siloviki war out of fear, driven by fear.
Not fear, but uncertainty. You're right.
Mark, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Didn't just go back to one point that Kirill made that I want to agree with about, you know, why would one sacrifice Bastrykin? I think the thing is, what we've got to realize is these are not about personal problems, personal issues. I mean, yes, there are all kinds of personal rivalries, but the big issues that are sort of consuming the Silovik elite are firstly sort of factional control over revenue streams and so forth, but also a sense of, well, where do we go from here? And I think that's one of the interesting dilemmas they're having, that behind all this is that sense of that the elite is rudderless at the moment. And the Siloviki, they're the ones who'd always be in the front line of dealing with problems with an opposition or whatever, and they're waiting for their lead. Now, why that is a concern is because the more the Siloviki become divided, frankly, the more important it is for them to get some kind of a strong lead from the center. And Putin's instincts in these cases, I think, will be to crack down rather than to be conciliatory. So in some ways, actually, the more divided they are, the more it provides an incentive for Putin to actually adopt a tougher line.
That's not a recipe for stability, in the next coming times. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. And with us via the magic of Skype technology has been special guest Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on the Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical blog on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.